Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
People from black and ethnic minority communities are being disproportionately affected by the coronavirus pandemic. In the last hour, the Office for National Statistics has released figures looking into deaths from COVID-19, broken down by factors including ethnicity. Black men are 4.2 times more likely to die of COVID-19, and black women are 4.3 times more likely to lose their life to COVID-19 than their white counterparts. Well, Sky's Inzaman Rashid is in the newsroom. Inzaman, people have long looked at the apparent disparity amongst deaths, but these are the hard facts.
They are. These stats coming out from the Office for National Statistics this morning, Adam. We've been talking about this for about 3 to 4 weeks now, ever since we got an idea that COVID-19 was disproportionately affecting the black, Asian and minority ethnic community. And now these stats really confirming that. We've had a lot of anecdotal reports and very early reports from different organisations, but these hard stats, which include figures from the ONS and NHS England and Wales, really are confirming that issue, that BAME people are disproportionately affected as a result of COVID-19, and the death rates are showing that. Now, these stats from ONS clearly say that the biggest risk appears to be in black men and women when accounting for age, which is what they've done in this analysis. Black men are 4.2 times more likely to die with COVID-19, and black women are 4.3 times more likely to die than their white counterparts. And the risk then is reduced slightly, but only to 1.9 times once the factors are taken in, and those factors include socio-economic factors and also health conditions. Now, the interesting thing about this report from the ONS is that it's actually the first time, Adam, that we've seen figures not only from hospitals across England, but also in the community across England and Wales as well. And it's the first time we're actually witnessing the ethnicity deaths amongst those communities in those two nations. And what it also suggests is that there are some important factors that are playing a role amongst the disproportionate number of deaths, and those include socio-economic issues and deprivation amongst the BAME community, and also underlying health conditions. Now, those could include things like type 2 diabetes, it could include heart problems as well, which is obviously a huge problem when it comes down to dealing with coronavirus when you are in intensive care and in those critical units. And also the social deprivation comes down to a number of factors, including overcrowded housing and cultural factors like multi-generational housing, where it really makes it quite difficult to self-isolate and to social distance in those areas, meaning that viral load is quite high. Now, there is a bit of discrepancy within these ONS figures, and there's a segment really where they haven't accounted for a specific factor, and that potentially could be a result of occupation. Adam, we know that people from a black, Asian and minority ethnic community are working in these key worker roles throughout this pandemic. A lot of them on the front line in the NHS fighting COVID-19, a lot of them driving buses. They're more vulnerable to getting the virus. Tube drivers here in London as well, and those working in shops as well. And that potentially also has a huge role to play in the disproportionate number of deaths. I just want to give you some more insight into this report from the Office of National Statistics as well. They say that males in the Bangladeshi and Pakistani ethnic group were 1.8 times more likely to have COVID-19 related deaths, and women from those backgrounds are 1.6 times more likely to have COVID-19 related deaths to their white counterparts. And they also say that Chinese and mixed ethnic groups are also amongst that group as well. So clearly, the ONS stats today confirming what we've been speaking about for the last 3 weeks, that there is clearly a disproportionate difference here in the number of BAME deaths in comparison to the general population. And what the questions will be now to the government is, what are they going to do to try and prevent further deaths like this happening throughout this pandemic, and if another one happens in the future?
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, May 12, 2020. So I have been told. I felt like we didn't have the best connection. Not sure if it's racist interference or what have you, but hopefully you all can hear me okay. You can raise a hand. Folks that are listening in live, just raise a hand, *61. Looks like my audio is coming through okay there. So just letting folks know, I did have some difficulty dialing in, which has been the case for some time, and just some odd, almost sounded like there was another caller on three-way or something. It was kind of peculiar. Not that I haven't had that happen before. Usual suspects, blah, blah, blah. All right. Our broadcast for today, irregular time. We normally are on 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, but we are on substantially earlier because I've said pretty much since all of this got really serious in the United States. So that was like middle part of March, around the second, third week of March or so, when it got really serious here. They started having lockdowns and everything. That it's been very confusing trying to get accurate information about exactly what is happening and, you know, what's the best way that we should move forward. I've said pretty consistently that one of the way, really, I've been saying even before we got to all this with the virus, I've said consistently that the system of white supremacy racism is global. Always constructive, I think informative, for victims of white supremacy to exchange views around the planet, to get a better grasp of how racism, white supremacy is work. The same problem we're all dealing with, just, you know, slightly different manifestations of that problem. So I think that's super helpful. With this, I think it's even more helpful because there's so much confusion, suspicion, doubt about what's being reported for good reason. Racist primary weapon is deception. So here I think it's especially important. We can see different ways that folks are responding to the virus, different reports, different information, what sort of scientific information, you can put that in quotes almost, is being presented in different parts of the world, how they're going about the reopening process, just lots of different things we can process. Even one tragic consistency, the report that we heard at the beginning, black males 4.2 times more likely to die than their white counterparts, black females 4.3 times more likely to die than their counterparts. We've heard that sort of data before here in the States. Some folks do not think that's accurate. We shall see. Maybe they are lying all over the world. Joining us today live, our guest in the UK, he's been with us before. We've been here for 11 years. You can go back in the archives, 2011. He was here. We talked about some of the work that he does. The organization he founded, Legally, they are linked in the description for the program, LIGALI. You can follow them on Twitter, /LIGALI.org. LIGALI.org. See, that's why I said that little, I don't know what that is, but yeah, could be interference. Anywho, but you can go to the website for Legally, Legally.org, Legally.org. They are all about examining racism, white supremacy, how it is manifested in the media representation of black people in the United Kingdom. Something that we've talked about quite a bit, even with the so-called London riots back in 2011. Pretty regular. Some global consistencies within the system of white supremacy. But specifically, I was looking at some of his social media posts, and he was talking about, let's see, just from yesterday. Now, he has a lot of posts, but this is just from yesterday. Don't be confused by Boris's, this is Prime Minister Boris Johnson, by Boris's guidance. As usual, there is no comment on the risks faced by African, Asian, and minority ethnic people. If you are worried about your job, please find legal representation advocate familiar with Section 44 of the Employment Rights Act 1996 and an accompanying video. Taking it seriously, racism, white supremacy is the sickness. That was why I said, hey, it would be great. Get him on the program. Let's see what, you know, he thinks about all this, some of his views. And that way we can learn a little bit here, you know, even how the perspective about what's happening here in the States and other parts of the world, what's happening in China, how that's being reported in the UK. So thought it would be great to have him back on the program. He could share a bit of his Tuesday evening with us, joining us live for the second time, founder of Legalee, Mr. Toyin Agbetu. Toyin, you with us, sir?
Yes, I am. Greetings, Brother Gus. Thanks for having me back on.
Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your time and energy. I know it's, you know, stressful and chaotic, so you could be doing a lot of other things. We appreciate you hanging out with us for the evening. For folks, I'm sure for a lot of folks, this is their first time hearing from you. Any information you would like to share with them about who you are, the work that you do with Legalee?
You know, I mean, I'm just a big mouth. I'm a Pan-Africanist. I just love my people, and I just don't like injustice. That's enough. We can deal with other stuff later. The fact is that I'm hearing that you guys are under the same system of white supremacy that we're facing over here, and it's affecting my family in the States just as much as it is affecting us in the UK. And that's not even to talk about the global issue. So I'd rather just get straight to the point to what we're here for, bro.
Absolutely. For folks who haven't seen you, well, should be self-sufficient, just making sure. You're a black male?
I'm an African, yeah.
African. Gotcha. All righty. Things got serious here in the United States around the middle of March in terms of lockdowns and what have you here in Washington State on the West Coast. We are on lockdown until the end of the month. Things in the UK, I remember we had our Global Sunday talk on racism about the third week. So this is, I think, March 19th. You all were not on lockdown at that point. Boris Johnson had come out and said, we're not doing all that. We're not, you know, wrecking our economy and going through all that, you know, hoo-ha, and herd immunity was talked about and all this. And I think within about 2 weeks, he got sick. And then it was, oh man, we got to take this serious and lock all this down. And they thought he was going to die for a little while. And, you know, it has been amazing just watching all of this unfold. Can you talk about when all of this started to get serious and it seems like you're taking it serious. So can you just talk about, you know, it going from, we're not doing the lockdown, we're not doing all that. And then, wow, Prime Minister Johnson might die. We should take this serious.
The lockdown happened before his illness, in all fairness. There's something you've got to understand about the British government and the way that the system works. It tends to believe it's actually far superior than other systems of supremacy around the world. So while you're dealing with the orange one in the White House, the government here tends to think that it has the edge on intelligence and it likes to be different, what they call an outlier. So when the reports were coming around the world about this virus and other countries were in lockdown, the government here thought, let's be clever, and they thought, okay, let's try this herd immunity. What happened, however, was that there was a huge kickback by the public against it. And while the government refused to shut down public events and the clown, we call him the clown, Bojo the clown, that's Boris Johnson. While the clown was walking around, shaking hands with COVID patients and spreading it to everybody and still leaving massive sporting events to take place. What happened was that other companies, private companies, sports companies, event managers said, you know what, if the government's not going to shut down, we're going to shut down. And so they started to unilaterally say, okay, I'm afraid we're closing down this venue for this event for this year. This festival's not taking place. And it was a cascading effect. It was one after the other. So the government was kind of pushed into lockdown. What happened, it was losing face. People were making a decision for them. And so what they did is what they usually do. They followed what was the populist agenda, and they said, okay, we're going to lock down. It was only after that, like a week or two after that, that we found out that the clown had contracted the virus, probably when he was going around hospitals, shaking the hands of patients and spreading it to everyone. He became a super spreader, basically. So that's kind of like the rough timeline of what happened.
Were you taking things seriously, or did you have any, suspicions or doubt that this was really happening, that there was a coronavirus, or did you take it serious immediately?
No, I mean, I didn't have any doubt. It was a serious issue. I have a son, who has sickle cell, and so that opens him up to vulnerabilities to this virus. So my wife and I sat down and said, you know what? We're not taking a risk with our child's life, so we're going to pull him out of school. So a lot of parents kind of said, something's not quite right. We can see what's going on around the world, but Britain is doing its British thing where it thinks it knows better than everybody else. So we pulled our son out of school. 2 days afterwards, the school started to shut down. So, I mean, it was a very strange time. Some people were saying, no, they're just overreacting. And other people were just saying, like myself, something is wrong. And my gut instinct tells me, to follow the spirit of my ancestors. And they're saying, get out of here. So, we took it quite seriously. In the early days, I actually thought to myself when I was looking at what was going on in Korea, I remember saying to my family, I thought to myself, you know what, I'd rather just catch the thing and deal with it naturally. I don't really like taking medication unless I absolutely have to, and heal from it and then just move on. That was my initial stance on it. And then what happened, as more data came out, and I'm a very nerdy person, so I like data, I like evidence, I like facts. My spirituality is strong, but I also, the nerd in me is also strong. And I started to see what was making us vulnerable, which group was vulnerable. And I saw that, I have a couple of health conditions which I just lived with, and I don't take medication for them. So I've got high blood pressure, and I don't like the ideas of taking blood pressure tablets for the rest of my life, so I don't take blood pressure tablets for the rest of my life. And I realized, Twin? You're taking a risk here. You're taking a risk because what was happening.
Yeah.
It sounds like you've got your intelligence agencies hacking into your station, by the way.
I know, right?
Yeah. We used to do that. That used to happen to us when we ran our radio program in the UK. That just means that you're doing something good. So don't watch that one. It kind of came to a point when I realized that actually I'm going to have to look into the facts. I'm going to have to look into what's going on around the world. And I'm going to have to look to see who's recovering and who's not. And when I started to see more data, more evidence, more countries starting to fall, I realized that, we can't. I mean, I never have listened to the government in the first place, but it kind of became clear that, they're not going to offer any kind of sensible guidance. They're just interested in the economy, which is the god of most Western nations.
Context of white supremacy, Mr. Toyin Agbetu. That right there, I think, is black self-respect. We talk about that all the time. I do not have children, but being an attempted parent, and all the information and having to make decisions. Do we put our child in school? And particularly you having people say, oh, you're overreacting. That's ridiculous. What are you talking about? Taking your child out of school and there's no virus. Like, man, it is tough having to make the, and then it turns out, looks like you all did make the right decision. You all were ahead of the curve. Then they, turned around and closed the school down. So brought black self-respect. Bravo.
Thank you.
Because I know, in the UK, I'm assuming, because I have seen reports where people over there, they had looked like a woman who would be classified as white. She went out and accosted someone who looked like they were servicing a 5G tower. And she said, oh, my God, you're putting up the 5G. That's how we're all going to get the Rona, and you're going to kill us all. We'll all be in hospital. And then they had other videos of people running out in the streets, and they were burning the cell phone towers. We have had rampant conspiracies here in the United States. We have had white people out protest, armed white people, like thousands of them out protesting and saying that there is no virus, that this is all a lie, and lots of there's no Rona, don't take this serious, and or, you know, whatever they think this is. Is that rampant in the UK as well, the confusion and there's no virus type thing?
It was initially, and there's still a lot of us who are in denial. But I think it's useful to be able to embrace as part of your family those people who actually have alternative views. And I say that because when this first happened, when it all started to leak out, there were theories going around that African people, black people, I don't use that term, but I mean black people, were immune to it. And then what happened when we started to find people catching it that we knew, some people were saying that those people were sellouts, they were working with the government, and these are people that we've known for years. And then the 5G theory started to hit out. Then the Bill Gates theory hit out. And the problem with all these theories is that there's an element of truth to parts of them. And that makes them much more difficult to deal with. I have a policy that I don't really care what theories people have. If it helps them to deal with the fear, to understand what's going on when we don't have enough information, it's not my business to kind of like tell them that they're speaking nonsense, because sometimes they're not. Sometimes we don't know all the facts. But my issue is when it starts to block our survival. I'm a Pan-Africanist, so I love African people wherever they are on this planet. And I embrace that diversity of African people and our form. But there comes a point in time when it doesn't matter what you think causes the problem. That's something we could deal with afterwards. The first thing we need to do when we start seeing us drop on the floor is to survive. And when it comes to survival, that's when the nerd in me kicks in. That's when I want to know the facts. I want to know where we're dying, how we're dying, you know, what's causing it, how can we avoid it. But I'm not so interested in the politics at that particular stage. So across the UK, you had people burning 5G towers, and you know, and there were other people arguing, saying that you're crazy. Then the talk about the vaccination, and I don't get me wrong, I get all that talk. But the most important thing that we needed to know was that people that we loved were dying. Elders were dying. And, you know, that narrative kind of was getting buried with all the hysteria. And it was useful seeing what was happening around the world, because that kind of helped us to understand that actually we weren't alone, you know, in these kind of like theories and stuff. But it's kind of like, I mean, it's kind of like a climate change thing. When Europeans en masse are panicked about something, it spreads across the world like wildfire. And a lot of us Africans who don't really understand structural racism, we don't understand white supremacy, we don't understand economic imperative, we don't understand the Caucasus consensus, when we don't understand these kind of basic, I say basic, it's not fair. When we don't understand, it takes time to learn these things, because the first thing most people do when they're confronted with that kind of truth is deny it. It's denial, and I understand that. But when we don't understand that, then we tend to follow what the noisiest people are saying. And the noisiest people were saying loads of stuff that was distracting us from dealing with the issue. In fact, that only changed when it started to become obvious that we, as African people, were actually dying far more. What happened was that people in our health service started to drop like flies. They started looking at the pictures of who was dropping like flies in health service. And all of a sudden, they noticed, actually, these are African and Asian people and people from minority ethnic communities. And that's when people started to think differently.
Number one, this is from The Voice Online, UK journalist, UK publication, black publication. They're talking about this specifically. They write, figures from the Office of National Statistics show that black people from a black and minority ethnic background are more than four times more likely to die from COVID-19 than white people. And recent research from the Health Service Journal found that although black and minority ethnic healthcare workers make up 16% of the National Health Service workforce, they form 63% of health workers who died from COVID-19. Now, my question.
That's right.
A number of folks in the United States, they have taken the, or I won't say a number, but there are several folks who've taken the position that this information is not accurate, that the black people might be dying, but they, you know, might have the high blood pressure and things. You said you had pre-existing conditions, that a lot of these black people that are dying, they had pre-existing conditions, so it might not necessarily be the virus, and or they think that this information is being put out to give so that people will think of this as being like a black disease. They won't think of, you know, oh, we should take this at like, oh, this is just a black disease. We don't have to worry about it. That's just, you know, something for the black people. Have you seen any indication that this is being thought of as a black disease and or that these numbers are being inflated, that black people might be dying, but this is not related to the coronavirus?
Yes, I have seen that over here as well. There's a problem with that narrative, and I don't know how to speak any other way than just tell it as it is. But one of the problems with some of the people in our family is that if you haven't lost someone from this virus, or if you had it and you recovered from it, I mean, bearing in mind that over 80% of people recover from it, and some people recover with it quite easily, some go through a really bad time. So if you've recovered from it quite easily, and you haven't lost someone from it, then it's really easy to think that this is just all hype, because sometimes we can have a lack of empathy for others. But if you know someone all your life who's quite healthy and they've passed away from it, you know, or you have friends who passed away from it, or you've had it yourself, or, you know, someone close to you has had it themselves and you almost lost them, you know, you saw the danger they were in, then what happens? That kind of sharpens your mind. It's kind of like those Africans who are like, well, slavery wasn't that bad, you know, because at least they got their food and they were looked after and the master looked after the house for us and stuff like that. Well, there's a saying that we have, those who feel it know it, you know what I mean? And if you haven't experienced it at that level, you haven't had that contact, then it's easy to make it into some abstract theory. It's kind of like the liberal who says, yeah, I'm an anti-racist. I feel your pain. I understand what it feels like. Actually, this is the first time in history for a long time that Europeans are feeling what we feel when the police are actually harassing them on the streets. It's the first time they've actually had that experience where they can't walk around with their privilege without the police checking them. But that's another issue. What helped us in the UK initially, I'd say, is that we were starting to see the figures coming out of places like Chicago. And that was really interesting. We don't hear anything about America now, about how it's hitting you. But in the early days, what was going on in Chicago was reaching over here in some of the newspapers, not many, none of the tabloids. And we were saying, whoa, hold on, there's a habit that we're aware of. If it's happening in the States, you know, it doesn't take that much longer before it happens in the UK. And so that kind of like woke us up. Of course, where we're affected by African and Asian people, over there where we're hearing that it's affecting African Americans and Hispanic community. And so what this started to tell us was actually this isn't a black disease, as they call it, because if you look at the Caribbean, if you look at the motherland, well, even though there are cases there, we're kind of recovering quite well, and hopefully, you know, it stays under control. So something else is going on. And if you look at the picture and the data, and I'm just talking about facts now, not what I want to be true or what I hope is true. I'm just talking about the facts as we know it right now. If you look at the data, the places where we are dying at larger proportions to the ethnic majority are where we're the minority. And that's the global north, which also just happens to be the place where white supremacy, structural racism, whatever you want to call it, is at its strongest. So what this says is that this isn't a so-called black disease. It isn't actually, we're not weaker genetically, and that's why we're dropping. And that's what people are afraid that it implies. Some people think that, there's two theories, isn't there? That either we are genetically somehow inferior, and that's why it's hitting us, or we are the blueprint for the vaccine. So they can say, because, you know, African people are the ones who are most vulnerable, let's test it on them. That's the fear that we have, and that's the theories that drive some of the fears that we have. But you see, what's becoming obvious, if we just look at the evidence, is that actually, no, what we're starting to learn is that, yeah, some of us are having a weak immune system response to it, because maybe we have diabetes, maybe some of us eat far too much junk food, maybe some of us are not living healthily. We're not, there's a lot of unhealthy practices that we have. But more so than that, the society that we live in is also placing us at harm. So we are doing the low-paid jobs. There's something called the virus load or the viral load. So the more exposed you are to a virus, the more chance that it will overload your immune system. Now, if you are working from home, you're not going out, you can pay it, whatever the fee is to get your food delivered to you, you're not getting much of a viral load. Even if the postman knocks on your door and he's infected and you're breathing his air in for like 5 seconds, that might not be enough viral load to make you flare up. But if you're out every day doing security, doing transport work, cleaning the streets, doing construction, doing all the kind of things that our people are placed to do in white supremacist systems and societies, then all of a sudden, you're not getting hit by people with the virus once a day. You're potentially getting hit by people who've got it multiple times a day. And so this is another factor. When you combine that with our poor healthcare, our poor, and I hate to say it, those of us in the West, some of us have poor hygiene when it comes down to food and making sure that we're eating well. And all these things factor in. So I know it sounds complicated and it might sound like I'm splitting hairs, but this is not a black disease. If anything, this is a disease that's been empowered by racism. It's a bit too early. It's only 4 months or 5 months now to really, I like more data, but the evidence is showing that racism, where this virus exists and the places of racist society, the minority community is getting it in the neck.
Context of white supremacy, Mr. Toyin Agbetu. I wanted to make a point of emphasis talking about, because I thought that was so important, essential workers, they call them, because they talked about that on both sides of the pond, saying that disproportionately non-white people, black people are the ones out doing that. In fact, we had a number of listeners reported that they have observed a substantial change in like the delivery drivers, people who are bringing parcels to their residents, where it used to be white people. Now it's non-white people who are out there getting exposed and having to do all that. And there've been just tons of reports that these are the folks out on the front lines, as they say, not getting hazard pay, not having protective gear, who are exposed. Then I saw Al Jazeera, or it was on a number of reports, but I'm just reading from Al Jazeera. UK rail worker dies after man with coronavirus spat at her. It reads, a railway station worker in the United Kingdom died from COVID-19 last month after she was spat at and coughed over by someone claiming to have the virus, her trade union said on Tuesday. Transport union TSSA said Belly Mujinga, 47, contracted the coronavirus with a colleague within days of the assault. On the pair at London's Victoria Station on March 22nd. They were out on the concourse by the ticket office when they were assaulted by a member of the public who spat at them, the union said in a statement, I suspect someone white. The man coughed over them and told them he had the virus. Several days later, Mujinga's doctor requested she was given sick leave, noting that she suffered from underlying respiratory problems, the TSSA said. Comorbidities, they say. She was then stood down from work, but grew sicker, and on April 2nd was taken to hospital and put on a ventilator, it added. Mujinga died 3 days later, leaving behind an 11-year-old daughter and husband. The union said it had reported the case to rail industry safety watchdogs for an investigation and was also taking legal advice on the situation and supporting her family and colleagues. British Transport Police are also investigating the incident, it added. BTP did not immediately respond to an AFP request for comment. And I will stop there. They have photographs. You can see the victim. I'm just reading this because they reported repeatedly, in the U.S. at least, that this is a deliberate plan by white supremacists. They've had a number of reports. The FBI even, I believe, issued a statement on this where it was said racist white supremacists were advocating, if you get the virus, give it to the niggers. Go cough on them and spit on their doorknobs and put your bodily fluids on. Like, they had just really, I had read that. We played that. So some of our listeners even said, man, we should be thinking about that. Like, maybe they're trying to give it to black people. Medical apartheid. That was what they said. But this is in Al Jazeera. I'll make sure to post it. Did you, any follow-up that you wanted to get to that, sir?
Oh, no. I mean, that's kind of raw, that story, because that's only breaking here today, even though it happened a little while ago. And there are some people saying that the attack itself was actually racist. I mean, I don't know. We haven't got details or the footage on that yet. But the bottom line is that she was assaulted. In fact, two of the women were assaulted. And so we know that there's a good chance that that assault is actually a murder case. It's going to be investigated now. But this is kind of underlines what's happening in the UK. People are saying that, look, it's not safe for me to be out working. And employers are saying, well, you've got to go out anyway. And they're not giving them shielding. They're not making sure that they're safe. And, you know, we're getting hit. And, like, you know, this is what we call, you know, the same thing. We use a similar term, frontline workers. And the reality, the truth is that they're using our bodies to shield them. You see, the role of the government is supposed to be to shield the public, to shield the people from threats. But this is a strange one. So because the threat is invisible, what they're doing is they're using our bodies, the ones that are now, we're finding out, are vulnerable, the most vulnerable to the situation, to shield the most privileged. And even though we can talk to those people in our family and say to them, look, you need to just tell your employer to redeploy you, just pull you into the office and let them sit at reception for a couple of months. Let them do security work. You can hang by the photocopier and do what they do. They can give you some in-house training. But, you know, this is the crunch time. If you really care about all that diversity stuff that you talk about, all that anti-racism stuff that you talk about, let's just do a little redeployment exercise. And while this virus is still here, you go out and do my work. But they're not doing that. What they're doing is they're putting us out as the shield, and they're using our bodies to protect them. Let alone what's happening in the hospitals, where not only are our bodies used to protect them, we're actually putting our lives at risk, helping to heal them. So this is something that's not just happening in the UK. This is happening, like I said, in most places where we are under the knee of supremacist systems. But in the UK, we're kind of growing aware of it. But like I said, the danger is with our family members is that it's not enough to just shield them physically. We have to shield them economically. And this is why a lot of our people who know they're at risk are still going to work and still taking that risk, because they're petrified that if they speak to their employer, they speak to their managers, they ain't going to have a job. And it's not, you know, it's not panicking. Some of these employers are very vindictive. And if they don't have their salary, not only can they not eat, but they can't pay their rent. And when this is all over, they've got to deal with the risk that they're going to be evicted, and they may be put out on the streets with their families, their children. And so some people are making tough decisions, and they're saying, you know what, I'm just going to have to take the risk. And if I get it, I just have to hope I'm one of those in the 80% that make it. And I'm saying that that is unacceptable. That is just completely unacceptable. That is the opposite of a civilized society. That is actually the epitome of barbarism. And, you know, that, you know, that's what's happening in the UK. And this government has just done a really clever trick a couple of days ago. It's actually eased the lockdown. And in easing the lockdown, rather than deal with the issue that they must, that's the right thing to do, shield our people, which is what any sensible person would do seeing the data. Rather than deal with that question, they've said, you know what? We're going to just tell all the poor people, everyone of every background, just to go back to work. And that way, if everyone's dying, then they can't accuse us of racism. They can't say this is white supremacy. And that is a masterstroke of Machiavellian politics, but it doesn't make us safe. And like I said right at the beginning, as a Pan-Africanist, my priority is our survival. We have to live to fight another day. And so that's where we are in the UK as of now.
Context of white supremacy. If you have a question, want to take advantage, get a question in to Toyin Agbetu. The number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I know here in the States, they've had a number of reports in New York City specifically, and some other places, I think, instances of black people being harassed, sometimes violently, for social distancing, violating social distancing policies, not having a mask on, or being out in public, that sort of thing. Have you heard of any reports of that type of thing happening in the UK?
Well, yeah, it's a complex picture, because the UK has an aversion to wearing a mask. For the longest time, you know, when we have seen people, you know, from China, from Hong Kong, from Korea, walking around with a mask, culturally, it's been seen as a joke. Like, you know, why they're walking around with a mask? They're so worried about fumes. They're so weak, and so there's something that, you know, it's taken time for people to get used to the idea that they have to wear masks. But what the police are doing is abusing their power to enforce what's called social distancing. So we've had some horrendous cases where, just the other day, a man in Manchester was tasered in front of his child. We're having people being accosted while other people are, you know, doing acts of violations of the guidelines, and yet they're picking on the Africans. And this is not new for us. The only thing, I won't say fortunate, the only thing that we can say that is we can be thankful for is that the police aren't routinely armed in the UK, because there'd be a lot of us dead. We were quite angry when we saw what happened to Ahmad, who was murdered jogging in the States. I mean, we, even as a community, even if it doesn't make the mainstream news, or it's only on the news for like 10 seconds, we kind of keep an eye on what's happening to our family in the States, especially when it comes to police shootings and deaths in custody. But yeah, the policing in the UK is quite tricky, because what's happening, like I said, they are abusing us, but they're also abusing the ethnic majority. And that, you know, that, like I said, it's probably the first time that I've seen non-Africans feeling what it's like. And they're getting a nice look at what it's like. They're not getting it the way we get it, where we're locked up in jails and we're criminalized and we have records and we can't, you know, they're getting a soft touch version of it.
I was able to, I had not heard about the tasing incident, but I guess that did get a good bit of attention. And this is from ITV. They list the suspect as Desmond Ziggy Mambayara. Ooh, hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Sounds right.
They said, they write, he appeared before magistrates on Friday, where he admitted a number of offenses, including speeding, drink driving, failing to stop, and unnecessary travel. So it would seem like maybe this was a lot more than not social distancing. But
it's true. It's the social distancing thing they've added right at the end, because there was no way at the time that they could know that he was actually over the limit. I'm not for one moment saying that, you know, drinking and driving, especially when you have a child in your care, is the right thing to do. I'm completely opposed to that. But what I am saying is that if they were stopping him on the or social distancing, and he has his child with him, and they're tasering him in front of this child when that was completely unnecessary, then what they're doing is abusing their power, and they can cover it up however they want to cover it up. Like I said, I'm not saying that the brother was completely right, because of course if he's over the limit, he's over the limit. But what I am saying is that the laws that are being used now, the guidelines that are being used by the police, are covering up a lot of situations. I mean, I can tell you something that's happened the other day to me when I was riding home. I mean, I was on my way home on my bike. I saw a sister being surrounded by around five officers. So I stopped my bike and I started watching them, and they got funny. And so I pulled out my phone and I started filming them. And then one of them comes up to me and says to me, what you doing? And I says, well, I'm filming you. He goes, well, why are you filming us? I go, well, it looks like there's a disproportionate number of officers surrounding one sister. And he goes, well, that doesn't sound like you're complying with lockdown laws. There's a lockdown, isn't there? And I go, yes, I know, but I'm making sure my sister's okay. So he says, well, we have a camera, so you don't need to do that. You need to go on. And I go, well, I want to make sure she's okay. He goes, well, if you don't, then I can take it to the next level. I said, what's the next level? You're going to arrest me. And then this is what he said to me. He said, no, but I will fine you for violating the lockdown laws, because if you're filming me, then you are not exercising. You are not complying the lockdown guidelines. You see, that's what I was talking about. It made me furious, but there was little I can do. So I shouted out to the sister to make sure she was okay, but he had me. I couldn't do anything. And this is how they're abusing. I haven't even shared this. I've got the footage on my phone, and I still haven't shared it, because it just made me so angry. It's not often that I feel powerless as a brother, but, you know, it made me furious. So this is the kind of subtle way that the lockdown laws are being used to abuse our people. You're just not hearing about it, but it's happening.
Wow. Context of white.
That's an exclusive here, man. I've not told anyone about it, apart from my family. I'm livid.
I can't imagine. Wow. That is the system of white supremacy, and I so appreciate you sharing that example. That is the sort of thing. It would not surprise me if that happens worldwide, where this can become an excuse for all sorts of abuses of black people. And just to acknowledge black self-respect, to have the courage to, even in that, you know, under those circumstances, to try and do what you can to support, look out for another victim of racism. I know we had at least one person they wanted to know, did you all get any sort of economic stimulus? I know you were talking about supporting other black people, family members economically. Did they give out any sort of stimulus in the UK?
Yeah, they did. There's something called the furlough scheme. So what happens if you're employed, your employer can furlough you. And this means essentially that the government will pay, I think it's 80% of your salary, up to £2,500 a month. So people who were employed in the system could essentially retain their salary. What people don't understand is that the way the scheme is set up, it maintains the system of inequality. So if you was a manager earning, let's say, like a 50 grand a year, then you'd get your same monthly salary as long as it was under the 2,500. And if you were earning in the same company 10 grand a year, you'd get the same salary. So people were happy because, of course, they're getting some kind of money. The problem is, obviously, the system's been designed specifically to maintain those systems of inequality. Where the stimulus package has failed people is when it comes to self-employment and rent. So if you're self-employed, I can't remember the exact numbers, there are certain limits to the threshold. You have to be self-employed for over a year. And a lot of people in the UK who come from our community are in what's called a gig economy. It's very precarious. So it means that, you know, they have, we call them zero-hour contracts. So they don't know when they're working, when they're not. They can be told in, like, you know, a day's notice, come in tomorrow. And so they don't qualify for this stimulus. So they have to apply for what's called a universal income or universal credit, that's it, which is a thing where you kind of like get unemployment benefit if you qualify and you jump through the hoops and rub your tongue at the same time, all kinds of stuff.
Sorry about that. Got disconnected. I didn't know we had dropped from the program line. I will get our guest back with us as well. I had to disconnect him also. We'll get him back on the line. My apologies for that. The archive should be pristine. Let's see.
Greetings.
Oh, okay, awesome. I was trying to, we got disconnected briefly from the broadcast line, so when I was hooking us back in, it dropped out. I lost you. You were giving the response on the stimulus in the UK, so I got in the part about it maintains the system of inequality, that if you have a manager who is making, you know, 10,000 or 40,000 pounds or whatever it is, then boom, they still get that, or 80% of it, as long as it doesn't go over the threshold. And then if you only make 10,000 pounds, well, then that's what you get. And everybody's happy because they do get some funds, but it's still maintaining exactly what you had.
Right. So what I was saying after that is that there was also a system where people who are self-employed were being let down. I don't know if you saw that. Greetings. Are we still connected?
Oh, yes, sir. We can hear you. We can hear you. Yes, sir.
Ah, okay. Sorry. Yeah, so people who have been self-employed were being caught. A lot of our people here are employed also in what's called the gig economy or zero-hour contracts. So they have no stable working hours. They can get called 24 hours notice to come in for work. And so the self-employment stimulus was saying that you have to have been in self-employment for a year, then have a year's worth of records. And because people were kind of like, you know, running multiple streams of income, they couldn't prove that. So they weren't entitled to that. Now, there is something called a universal credit, which is like unemployment benefit. And so some people, you know, who can provide, like loads and loads of information, pat their tummy and rub their stomach, pat their head and rub their stomach at the same time, they might be eligible for it. So there were some packages. But one of the issues that people aren't really addressing is the fact of rent. You see, what happens, like the government gave a stimulus, so they gave what's called a mortgage holiday, or some kind of break for on property. So they had like 3 months where they mortgage holiday, that was it. So they could actually not have to pay their mortgage for that time, and they can catch up later on. Everything's about debt. And for people who are renting, they gave no such break. What they said was, we'd make sure that you couldn't be evicted during that time. And then the government started issuing loans. So no interest loans, but people had to find the money afterwards, after a year with no interest, to pay them back. And this is similar to the system of how Arthur was transformed into a system of economic enslavement. This is what Eric William talked about in Capitalism and Slavery. This is where people are put into debt, and when you're put in debt, you'll do anything to service the bill. You're forced into the situation. So it's a strange stimulus, because in one level, people are getting something to eat, and they're getting a bit of money where they can kind of feel they can survive, but they're being given debt. Debt at a time when rent should be suspended, mortgage should be suspended, everything should be suspended. What's happening is that people are just building up more and more and more and more debt. But what I do want to say that's happened, which is really heartening, is that there's been a wealth of community organizations, local restaurants, food banks, but I've actually gone above and beyond the call of duty to provide food to those who are vulnerable. So people are, from what I can hear, there was a time when 1.4 million people were going without food for at least a couple of days in the UK. But now what's happening is that a lot of people, even some of the local authorities, to their credit, are actually making sure that those people who don't have money are getting packages of food that are sent to them. And that's a good thing. The only critique I have on that is that that is not the responsibility of community organizations and local restaurants, who are going to be petrified of their rent debts and all of the loans they've had to take out to survive this. That is the responsibility of government, because we are forced to pay taxes. And if we're paying taxes, then what should have happened, whether it was universal basic income, whether it was a suspension on food prices and make sure the staple foods weren't provided free of charge. You know what I mean? It should not have been a government looking to maintain a system of inequality or issue out, you know, billions in loans to people, expecting them to pay it back after all this madness. But that's the kind of, that's my take on the stimulus. Not everyone's going to agree with me. Some people think the government's been fantastic because it's offered all this. I think it's a cynical ploy. Some of it's good, but the long-term side of it all is that it's designed to maintain the system of white supremacy and the economic system, which is already grossly unfair. And, you know, to its credit, that's what it's been doing for hundreds of years. They know their game. It's up for us to up our game.
Hmm. So just to make sure, like in the U.S., our president, the government, they issued stimulus checks. I guess some people have not gotten them yet, so that, you know, there is more details. But generally, stimulus checks, you sign up. If you have taxes on record filed for 2019 or what have you, bam, $1,200. I think it's adjusted if you have children or what have you. Not a loan, just here you go, $1,200.
Wow.
To help get through. Did they do anything like that? Just a flat check? Here's...
Nothing like that. You're talking about basically universal basic income, where the government makes sure that everyone gets a salary. Now, the government stimulus plan is, like I said, it's clever. It's done that if you had a salary, then we'll pay 80% of that salary. It didn't say, which what a egalitarian system would say, that everybody should be paid the same amount. It didn't say that. It didn't, you know, what it's done, it says that if you're happy to apply for our system, we will give you loans to make sure that you can pay your rent, you know, and you know, you can pay it all back after the interest, 1 year of interest-free credit. But no, I mean, I can't, it's amazing that your orange leader has actually done something better than our clown. I mean, that's, you know, I never thought the day would happen, but hey, you know, we'll see what, you know, white supremacy sometimes is a strange thing.
Have to see how, you know, everything plays out with the reopening and all, and, you know, $1,200, I think, for most folks is, because that's just a one-time thing. It's not like that's recurring. We have to see.
Oh, it's a one-time thing.
Yes, yes, that was just a one-time thing, and, you know, they have other loan-type dealies, but yeah, that's not like a ongoing monthly $1,200 payment. This is a one-time installment, so, yeah.
So what happens to renters?
They have, well, it depends. Now that, because where I am in Seattle, Washington, they issued a moratorium. They did not issue any sort of stay, and, you know, you don't have to a foregoing of rent. They didn't even do that for college students. I think for some of them, they got refunds if they were staying on campus and they closed the school down or what have you. But nothing like a moratorium. They did put, in some areas, they did put the same thing that you all got, a stay on evictions, but nothing like, oh, okay, well, there's a program that'll make sure that your rent is paid, or, you know, we're going to cut your rent in half for the next, like, nothing like that at all. Yeah, I haven't heard of anything like that anywhere in the country, in fact.
So does that mean that African-Americans are just building up debt? Obviously, that $1,200 has got to go towards food and keeping yourself alive. So does that mean rent is just building up?
It could be. For a lot of the folks that we've talked to, at least people that have called in, participated, that I've spoken to directly, they are in the essential worker category. So, you know, you can look at that in a lot of different ways, that, you know, they are being able to work steadily. So that, you know, is helpful. But that also means you might be exposed. We do have some folks who are working from home, but we have a lot of folks who they have not been just, you know, you get to go and sit at home and put your feet up like they've had to just work right through this.
Yeah.
We have had some folks who said that they have been either furloughed or unemployed. We have had some folks who did say that they went ahead and were able to use the internet and get unemployment filed. I know, you know, that's been cumbersome depending on the state that you're in as well. But it's been kind of, I'm sure there's a lot of that as well. We probably just have not heard directly from as many of those people, but yeah, I'm sure that would have to be happening, accumulating debt and just then a lot of stress and worry. Even some of the folks that I know who they have not been furloughed, they're working, they're an essential worker or, you know, they're working from home or whatever it is. They still have, you know, just a tremendous sense of anxiety just about, you know, is it, you know, going to continue? Are we going to continue to have our job? Is it going to be, I mean, it's just a lot to be anxious about.
I mean, the problem is that one of the things that we're seeing right now is that let's put it this way, this is the critical moment, right? This is when people are at risk, when people are dying. And at this critical moment, you know, we're seeing big companies like fire people. They're letting people go, mass redundancies. And this is not just Africans. This is like, they're doing it to even their own.
Right.
So this is what they're doing at the crisis. So my concern is, once this stage of the crisis is finally over, if they are sacrificing not just our jobs, but also our lives now, what on earth is going to happen afterwards? And I think that's what we've got to prepare for, because they are working on what they want to be the new normal. And I'm not sure that we are prepared for that. One of the things that happened when we went into this is that, I don't know about in the States, but most African families in the UK, we've maybe got a couple of $100, in savings. And so after the first few weeks, we were in problems, and hence why so many people just kept on working on the front line, because they just had to keep things going. But you see, afterwards, it's like, that's when we've got to be alert. That's when we've got to be creative. Because then that's when I think stuff's really going to get real. And I don't think we kind of understand it yet. I'm not a person who likes to scaremonger. That's not my style. I don't like conspiracy theories. I think there's enough wickedness going on in the world. I don't need to make stuff up. But that, for me, is a serious concern. Even those people on the front line now who feel like, you know what, at least I'm still working. It's like when European companies lose millions and billions of their shareholder values and their profit, they have a ruthless policy of cutting the workers that they think are disposable. And one thing that this crisis has shown us, and that we have to learn, and a lot of us still don't get it, is that they think that we are disposable, that we are surplus to requirement. And that's what all this in England, we had the Brexit phenomenon. Anti-immigration is a big thing over here. I'm pretty sure we've got something similar with the orange one over there in the States. So this is my fear.
Grounded, logical sense. First hired. It's last hired. First fired. That's the cliche. Yeah. Context of white supremacy. Toyin Agbetu, founder of Legalee. You can visit the website, legalee.org. I think I gave the number while we were momentarily disconnected, so I'll do it again properly. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Much obliged to folks tuning in. Thanks for being patient while we were briefly dislodged. And tuning in live, like I said, this is way outside our normal broadcast time, but I think it is super important being able to talk to non-white people, different parts of the planet, see how similar the system of racism, white supremacy operates, and hopefully get logical information to help us make quality decisions moving forward. I was prepping for the program, and I looked at the BBC. I listen to try to check out their content regularly, but I was looking at the front page, and I was scrolling down, and most of it was COVID-19 related, and they had a report about the parks, and it was a robotic dog used to enforce social distancing in the park. And I was stymied on many levels. We watched the Black Mirror TV series, started off as a UK television program, I think on Channel 4, and they had the episode about the robotic dog going and hunting to kill people. It was a security dog, in fact, and they went to rob a warehouse, and the security dog went to hunt them down. And, I mean, just lots of things. Have you seen any of the reports, robot dogs being used to enforce social distancing in the parks?
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's actually in Singapore. Even though the BBC's covering it, that's not happening in the UK.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
That's happening in Singapore. But yeah, the Black Mirror is made by someone called Charlie Brooker. He's a good writer. He kind of has an insight to kind of like technology and social issues. And I remember that episode of Terminator dog that was just hunting people down. Yeah, that's a scary look at the future. Thankfully not doing that over here, not yet. But no, I mean, you know, one thing, I mean, no, that's not going to happen here. There's people like me who are complete nerds, and I'll just reprogram the thing, so it'll be too risky to do that.
Woo, strive for accuracy. Thank you for catching that. I was just startled, like, what in the world? Like, all right. But the fact that it is happening at all anywhere on the planet is wow, that is enough to pause. Like, wow, okay. At the same time I was checking, before I got to the robotic dog, the big story that they had was Ahmaud Arbery, the Black male who was shot in Georgia, and I was I won't say stymied, but wow, like, this is front page in the, like, has that gotten major traction? Have they been talking about Mr. Arbery quite a bit over there?
Sometimes I'm in a bubble, and the people that I hang with, we're all aware of the situation, and it made us angry. And so it has been covered. There is some news about it, but there's not much mainstream news about it. We have been talking about it a lot. I can't express the anger that we have, but no, mainstream news, no. I mean, you've got to remember, the mainstream news, even though it's covering the fact that African people and Asian and other minority ethnic people in the UK are at more risk from this virus than anyone else, you've got to understand that the politicians, when they talk in Parliament, when they make their daily briefings, they do not mention it. The only time it comes up in their briefings is if someone from the public or from the media asks them a question about it. So one of the tactics that's been done in the UK, and it's been done very successfully for many, many years, is to keep news of what's happening to us around the world, so whether there's an uprising in France or whether there's something going on in America, they try to minimize it. The only time they talk about it is when it's so big that they know that we are angry about it, and then they'll do something briefly on it, and then they'll push it under the carpet. But generally, they don't like us hearing about it.
Didn't even want you talking about it, apparently, because that we just heard them speak up, like, you're not even supposed to be discussing that. Diane Abbott, she's a MP over in Britain. She has spoken up pretty regularly. I'll see reports where she's talking about white supremacy, racism in the UK, and she just spoke up this week about Prime Minister Boris Johnson not discussing racism, white supremacy, and how Black, they call it BAM, black and minority ethnics, how they're being impacted by the virus. We've had some folks, they've taken the position that when they come out with these numbers, that 4.2, that Black males are 4.2 times more likely to die from the virus than their white counterparts, and Black females are 4.3 times more likely to die, that those statistics are deceptive, racist, they lie a lot, you know. that those there's something deceptive about the use of those statistics, and that what they're doing is trying to focus this more on black people and take away from they don't ever want you to think of a disease as being this is a white person's disease, this is just killing white people, which is kind of how people thought of it, because they were saying black people are immune. You said that apparently they were saying that in a lot of places. They do not want white people to be thought of as sickly and unhealthy and that sort of thing, so that's why this is being amplified. Does that seem logical to you?
Changes depending on where you are. I mean, it was us that was saying that we were immune. It wasn't them. You know, that's the thing in the UK. We're going to be really honest. I mean, there is an argument that, you know, nobody wants to, you know, say that, you know, there's something that genetically makes Europeans predisposed to illness than anyone else, that they're the superior race. I mean, I suppose there is some, you know, merit to the argument. I don't think that's true in this case. I don't think that's what's happening, but it could be happening. I mean, I don't know. But the issue of racializing this, I can only say that it's because that's what the facts were showing. I mean, you know, I can look for a reason. I'd rather do that when we're out of danger zone. But all I can tell you, and then, you know, just straight up, is that we are dying. And there's a lot of us dying. And in fact, let me be quite clear about that, actually, because this is something else that comes with being a nerd. We are dying disproportionately compared to the ethnic majority. So if you look at the numbers of people who have died, and you look, you know, from the ethnic majority, and you look at the number of people that who have died from our community, then our number in comparison to theirs is very small. It's not a huge number. I'm not talking about the individual and what it means personally and spiritually. I'm just saying in a number level, it's only when you look at the rate, the disproportionality, then you can see that we are far more at risk, and you know, we should not be dying at those rates compared to everyone else. And so sometimes I think we get confused with proportionality and the actual raw data, the real numbers. No one is saying that, you know, it's like out of, I think it's what, 32,000 or 33,000 people have died in the UK, that out of the 33,000, that, you know, like 15,000 of them are from our community. If that was the case, that I would have to walk the street with a gun. I mean, that would be so out there. It's nothing like that. But what I can say and what people are saying is that compared to how many of us, it's the same thing like what's happening in Chicago, compared to how many of us are inside this country of, what, 65 million people, we should not be dying at this rate, which is far higher than the ethnic majority. And I know it sounds quite nuanced, but that's just the facts of the situation. And so that's why we've got to be careful when we start saying things like we're trying to say it's a black death, or it's something that affects us, or it's been, you know, racialized in that way, because that's not quite true, because the numbers are not saying that. You know, we are still nowhere near the numbers of the people, the ethnic majority, who are dying. What it is that our share of that number is far higher than what it should be, and that's why we should be shielded. I hope I made things a bit clearer.
It was logical to me, but if our listeners, if you are listening in live, if you have a question or would like something explained, need it, you know, broken down a little bit, feel free. Press *61 and we'll get you in. At least my thoughts, I'll see. Always like chatting with a nerd, see what they think, make sure I'm being logical in my thought process. My thinking, three of the countries with the highest death toll so far, the United States, leading the whole world, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
The UK, and then Brazil. Brazil and the United States leading the entire Western Hemisphere, by far, I think, not even close. And the three commonalities in those countries, so-called, is that it doesn't seem to be, from a federal level I'm talking about, it doesn't seem like it's being taken very seriously. We just played a report in Brazil where the president there was, you know, hey, let's go to work. You know, we're not doing all this. Same thing that I kind of heard in the UK. Like, we're not doing all this shutting down. Like, we got an economy to run and, you know, let's get out there and go to work, which was kind of the same thing that was happening here. And then when it gets serious and people start to die, it's still kind of not an adequate, solid, scientific, like, hey, we're going to take this seriously. Yeah. People are dying. Let's go about it. I've looked at this and said, if you're in an area, you have a lot of black people, they have Brazil, more black people in Brazil than anywhere else in the Western Hemisphere. But if you have a significant population of black people and you already know because of white supremacy racism, we already got these black people in a really unhealthy state. Africans, they're really unhealthy. They're not getting quality health care. We got them in areas where they're not going to have quality access to food. They're going to be so-called frontline workers, and we're not going to pay them well. So they'll be out working tons of hours and stressed. And when they go home, we'll have the police stop and harass them. So that'll drive their blood pressure up even more. So they're not healthy to begin with. They'll have lots of problems. So if any sort of virus, anything comes through, whammo, it's going to get them. Like, they'll be frontline workers. Like, they'll take a disproportionate swing. We'll have some white people that'll die too, but that'll just be white sacrifice. That happens sometimes. But the people that'll really get hammered will be black people. There'll be a lot of the folks that die on this one. Hey, we'll just be confusing about this. We don't really need to take this very seriously. We can give out some confusing information. Yeah, we will lose some white people, but, you know, mostly black people will take a disproportionate share. We don't need to take it serious. We can be kind of confusing in the information that we give. Does that seem like something that could happen in a system of racism, or is that not logical?
No, it's logical to one degree. I mean, there's two aspects to that. So let me do it. My instinct tells me, you know, looking at history, that the economy is God for the Western nation. So, yes. It's possible that, you know, that some of the leaders, there's people out there that are like, you know, whatever's collateral damage is collateral damage. This is an opportunity to reinvent ourselves. We're already worried about places like China. If there's going to be deaths and if it's going to come from, you know, I was going to say Negroes, because I don't really like saying that often, but that's how they see us. Do you know what I mean? Or the N word. Then so be it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we can stomach that, and then when this is all done, we can kind of come out of that. And there's some people who think like that, and there's people working on that plan right now. But when I look at the data as well, this is a funny thing about me is that I believe that Pan-Africanism only works when you link politics and spirituality together. So my spirit tells me that that's completely possible, and that actually some of that's true. But my other side tells me, well, if I'm looking at the data, well, around the world, and I'm on a site called the John Hopkins site, and they collate all the figures of what's going on around the world. So they look at all the confirmed cases, they look at all the deaths and all those who have recovered. And right now, we know that there are 290,000, this is an underestimate, of deaths that have been attributed to COVID. So you're right, the US is number one at 81,000 deaths, 81,800. Second is 32,000 is the UK. But actually, after that, it's actually Italy at 30,000, then France at 26,000, then Spain at 26,000, and then Brazil at 12,000. So that's kind of like the ranking as it stands as today. Now, there's something that links the attitudes of the leadership in the UK and the leadership in the US. You know, Bojo and the orange one are pretty similar in style, as is the leader in Brazil. You know, they are straight out white supremacists. They just have different styles in the way they do it. But that would mean we'd have to ignore what's happening in France, what's happening in Italy, because Italy was the highest case in Europe until the UK overtook it, and what's happening in Spain. And I don't do that. I can't take out data because it's inconvenient to my theory. So all we have so far looking at these figures, and these are the facts from today, you know, is that the two engines of white supremacy, the two nations that are involved in every conflict in history that have caused the deaths of not just African people, but other communities all around the world, is normally Britain and America. And they happen to be at the top of this list. And in both of those nations, African people are getting it worse. So for me, that becomes now the strongest theory. It doesn't mean that other theories are wrong. It just means that this is no longer a coincidence, because America and Britain are now the nations. One is the largest, one of the largest nations or populations, or I shouldn't say large nation because China is actually larger, but the most militarized nations in the world. And one of them is the mother of white supremacy, you know, the birth of African enslavement. So Britain and America are at the top. It's too much of a coincidence to say it's just because, you know, both the presidents and the prime minister are clowns. We have to acknowledge that there's something going on. That has to happen there. Now, Brazil, coming further down the list after Italy, France, Spain, Brazil has something to answer. And, you know, I know from friends who have been to Brazil that African people are not treated right over there. This is a problem we have to deal with. And hence, I'm sure if I was in contact with some of my Brazilian friends now, they would tell me that, yeah, there's a level of disproportionality going on inside there. But just dealing with the main data, and I know it sounds nerdy again, Britain and America, you know, the Tweedledee and Tweedledum of white supremacy, they are at the top. And it just so happens that we are also at the top of deaths proportionality in their countries, that this is not a coincidence. And that's how I figure it out.
Appreciate hearing nerds be logical. I would say we need logic, you know, that's important. I would say Italy, France, and Spain, just my difference in terms of how those countries responded in terms of the USA, the UK, and Brazil. I think Italy, France, and Spain, they had a serious federal response. Like I've said, I've reminded folks repeatedly, the people who've been annoyed in the United States with the social distancing and, you know, they're only allowing a certain number of people in the grocery stores at a time, and then you have to be like 6 feet apart at the cash registers and thing, people who've been annoyed with that. I said, man, if we were in Spain, you wouldn't even be able to do that. Like, they had, like, super lockdown. That's like, true. You can't even, in Spain, in Italy, like, they literally have been in their house. Like, they've not been allowed to do, like, anything. Like, you are just stuck. We had a guest on from China, and he said they could leave to go to the grocery store only on certain days. Like, you had a code based on your ID.
Wow.
And you could go out, I think it would be like, let's say your day would be Monday, Monday, Thursday, and Saturday. Those would be the days that you could go to the store. And if you miss it on those days, tough. And it was police in force. Like, let me see your ID. Are you authorized to be out today? Okay, go about your, or you end up in quarantine jail. And he said it was lots of folks who ended up in that trying to sneak out when it wasn't their day, like super hard lockdown. Like those countries, France, Spain, Italy, they had a serious federal enforcement. They took it seriously. Some of those areas are just easing their restrictions. The USA.
That makes a lot of sense.
The UK, Brazil, they did not have a serious federal response at all and still do not have a serious federal. In fact, it's been the exact opposite, like total what? Confusion. And sometimes the president it's just been all over the place in those areas. And then the people they get hit the hardest are black people. But certainly, I do not ignore France, Spain, Italy. Important, but they have had a serious response to this, much more so than here or where you are or in Brazil.
Well, that makes now we're using logic. That now gives us a theory to base on. So anyone who's had a good response, a good federal response, who's been looking after their people before their economy, has actually reduced the number of deaths. I mean, people don't actually remember that actually, I mean, the deaths in China are 4,637. It started in China, but the death count is 4,637. So, like, you know, something has gone so wrong, you know, with the response that's happened there. The only thing that I would really love to know, and this is how white supremacy is very good at, I would love to hear from the African communities in Italy, France, and Spain to see if they are at increased risk than anyone else. I mean, perhaps because the lockdown has been so tight that they haven't been on the front line, they're not at risk. I mean, I know there's definitely racism in France that affects us. And I have family who's traveled to Italy and they've experienced Afrophobia over there as well. But that's just me being a bit curious. But I think your explanation is perfect. I think you're right. If where the government has actually treated this thing seriously and imposed lockdown seriously, then what's happened is the death count has stayed, I won't say low, but it stayed lower. Whereas people have just been prioritizing getting the economy going. I mean, these are rich people who just want more money. Just be clear about this. These are rich people who just want more money. Where they've made that their priority, then we're seeing the deaths increase. And that's, well, you know, until people are prepared to collectively do something about it, well, you know, we just got to find ways to survive the system.
The system of white supremacy. My final little geography tidbit. The most dangerous place to be for the coronavirus, by far, like not even close, is the United States. Like not even close. That is the most dangerous place to be for this virus. Now, these borders are imaginary, but we'll pretend that they're like real. Like they got walls there. We'll pretend for a minute. So,
yeah.
Canada is right next door, and they have 5,000 deaths, allegedly. That's on the report for today. United States is over 80,000. Mexico, right next door, we'll pretend these, you know, we got walls there and everything. Right next door, they got 3,500.
Wow.
So you go from 80,000, all you have to do is hop across that water either way, and wow. Now, I will say Canada, they took this pretty serious. The border was shut down and all that. Keep our cooties over here. But they took this serious. Like, quarantines, they had people snitching. Like, we've heard from a number of folks in Canada, like, they took this really seriously. They have a substantially lower population of people than we do here in the United States. So that would have to be factored in, too. But they've taken this pretty serious in Canada. Mexico, they talked about saying that they thought it would be really bad there because they have a lot of the same health problems and obesity and all of that. 3,500, which is still a lot of people, you know. But I mean, that is nowhere near 80,000. We'll have to see how this goes. Again, that's just, you know, another little tidbit to think about. The most dangerous place in the world. By far, it's not even North America. It's just the United States. The
Let me complicate it even more. I mean, my heritage, I'm a Yoruba man. So my parents come from Nigeria. And so I was talking to my cousin, and he lives in Lagos, and they were on lockdown. And if you know, I don't know if you've been to Lagos. Anyone who's been to Lagos knows that we don't have the most robust healthcare system. We have just under 200 million people in Nigeria. And you know, we don't have it's a wealthy nation, but it's impoverished. All the money goes out of the motherland, like other African nations. The death count, and it's probably underreported. I'm not saying it's not, but the death count in Nigeria right now is 150 for a population of 195 million, I think it is. In Saint Lucia, that's where my wife is from. I don't have to count, but I know that they've got no more confirmed cases of COVID. In fact, I'll try and find a death count. So something is going wrong. It's not about how much money a nation has. It's not about how powerful its healthcare system is and how resourced it is. You know, it's something else is going on. And it's a good name. It kind of seems to fit this problem exactly. And like I said, I don't do conspiracy theories. So that, I just thought, you know, it'd be nice just to get, you know, we spoke about China, we spoke about America, we spoke about Brazil, we spoke about Canada, we spoke about Europe. On the motherland, we spoke about the most populous region on the whole continent. You know what I mean? And 150 deaths. I'm not saying it's not going to get worse. I hope it doesn't. But I do suspect that that the lifestyle of, you know, people in the motherland, diet, activity, that will make the immune system a little bit tougher. Medication-wise, I mean, you know, whenever I go home, I see elders who are like, you know, 80 years old, and they can lift me up with one arm and sprint around me. I mean, they understand, you know, living right. When you don't have much, you kind of not waste so much and put junk into it. I'm not saying we don't have problems back on the motherland, but, you know, these figures are saying wherever white supremacy is at its strongest, there's a problem.
Context of white supremacy. I think a lot of the different countries on the continent, they seem to take this pretty seriously early on as well, like shutting down borders and stopping travel. And they had more serious lockdowns as well. Like I saw a lot of footage of the police coming out to enforce curfews and things in South Africa and other areas. It seemed like a lot of those, again, substantially more serious than what we have had here in the United States, where we had folks out surfing and at the park, and in fact protesting to be out at the park and surfing at the beach and all the rest of it. So I'll ask one more time just to check so we don't take up Mr. Toyin Agbetu's entire Tuesday evening. Our number is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I do not have children. I like to say that often. I've emphasized that during this entire crisis because I just feel like, wow, being an attempted parent through all of this, like that would just add to the burden of all of this exponentially. You already talked about you and your wife. You all had a discussion, say, hey, we're going to take our child out of school. Just how has that been? Like, I assume, have they closed school for the rest of the school year, the calendar year?
Yeah, I mean, they're talking about reopening them in June in phases, so in June and July. But what's happening again, and this is probably a good thing about the way people operate in the UK, is that the teachers are saying, we're not opening schools until we know that it's safe to do so. Mm. So the economic system here can't function without the schools running, because people who are working, who have children, need somewhere for their children to be. So it's a very difficult position that the government's in. They can try to open the schools in June, like they say they're going to, but if they haven't done enough to suppress this virus, then the schools ain't going to be open. It's really, it seems that. When you are a parent, when you do have a child, what happens is that, well, I can't speak for everyone, I can speak for me, but for me, you know, as an activist, I take risks. You know, there's no way, you know, you can survive the system as an activist without taking risks, and that sometimes that puts your life at risk. But when you've got children, you've got to make different decisions. Well, I think you have to make different decisions, and you become more risk averse. You know, I don't mind if, you know, I do mind, but if something happens to me when out on the field, when I'm dealing with the police or whatever the situation is, that's a decision I made. But my children didn't ask to be brought into this world. I brought them here. That, we are responsible for that decision, and so I am not going to place my children at risk. And I think a lot of parents who aren't even activists, you know, feel the same way. And teachers, one of the things that's very clear with this virus, because children are at such a low risk of actually just developing into something serious, they get the infection, but their body, their immune system, for whatever reason, just swats it away like it's nothing. But they still get it. It's like there's something about the risk of children becoming super spreaders and spreading it to their grandparents and their parents and their friends and their neighborhood and all that sort of stuff. So I'll be very surprised if the schools open in June like the government plans. I mean, even the lockdown in this country in education has a major impact on African people, because what the government in the UK said was that those children who were going to take exams this year, they're not going to take the exams, but their grades are going to be assessed by their teachers. Now, you see, in this country, that's a nightmare if you are a child of a, you know, parent of a child of African heritage. Because if he doesn't like you, then they can make it to the mark that will affect the rest of your educational career. Then you get to the university of choice, you should go in college. And so there are some fears that we have about even that aspect of education and the lockdown. So, I mean, you know, my son's shielded. So, you know, we went to the hospital today because he had a transfusion every 6 weeks. But other than that, he's been fine. He's on his Switch and he's on his, you know, he's with his friends online. They're doing homework virtually with their school. My daughter's at uni. She's at home, so she's doing her exams in the kitchen. So I don't know how that's working. They're just safe, and that's how I like it. But you know, I know it's different for everyone else out there. Some parents are struggling with having their children at home all the time, and I can't write my PhD with my children at home. I'm in the final year of my thesis, and it's just almost impossible. And so that's a big challenge. And I also know, because some of the community work I'm dealing with, and it's something that we don't talk about, is that there are issues of domestic abuse happening in our families. And some, and I say this again, some, a small number of the boys in our community are unfortunately attacking some of the mothers. They're struggling to stay indoors. And that's leading to situations that, you know, we as brothers have to kind of try and deal with. With the government easing the lockdown a couple of days ago, that's going to change things. But it has been something that's been quite ugly that we're not really talking about. And then, of course, the final issue that we're not talking about is the impact on the mental well-being of our community. And I know personally of people who have had a really rough time. Forget about the conspiracies, just being forced to stay in, being controlled when they're out on the streets. It's not been good for them. So those are all the domestic kind of issues that surround what's happening in the UK. And like I said, the nightmare for us is that we don't really have an idea of how our family around the world is coping with it. So if we'd had more ideas of what's happening to you in America, what's happening to our family in Germany, what's happening on the motherland, it would probably help, because we can share ideas. But the communication system in the UK, the media networks in the UK, doesn't tell us that. And so programs like this one are so crucial. And it's a shame that it would have been lovely to hear some people ask some questions and get that dialogue back and forth. And I'll be more than happy to come on again and give you an update whenever you need me to. But we've got to keep these lines of communication going, because the biggest trick of white supremacy, what it does to neutralize the effectiveness of our activism, is to make us think that we're alone, to make us think that we're individual crazy people, and it's the majority that are out there who have got all the answers. And those of us who are talking about these kind of things, we're just kooks and we're just crazy. And that's clearly not the case. And that's how the system works. So, I mean, before I leave, I know we've probably got another 15 minutes. I just want to pick you up for what you're doing, Brother Gus, because this is revolutionary work. People don't kind of understand. Garvey had... God, I forgot the name of the newspaper. What's gone wrong with me, man? It's getting late. It's gone. He had newspaper. That's going to really irritate me now.
I've forgotten to. It's not the Black Star. The ship I know was the Black Star line. I don't think it was the Black Star.
The Negro World, I think it was. And, we are modifying. We have to constantly evolve and use whatever technologies are at our hand to move forward. And as much as people are using, like Zoom and all these other platforms, and they're good for what they do, the one technology, well, there's two technologies that are enduring, especially at times of war. And, you know, I don't say this often enough, but we are at war. We haven't started it, but there is a system that's at war with us. And so we have to defend ourselves. And the two technologies that have always helped us through this time is literature. So I'm talking about books and songs and drawing, anything that's oratory, anything that's kind of sharing that way. And just radio, where we can work and listen. And we can listen to our songs and our poetry and our scientists and our theorists and our healers. And you know what I mean? And I think in this world of quick YouTube videos and Instagram photographs, we're forgetting how cool and dishing out and reasoning. You know what I mean? I think Walter Rodney calls it a grounding with my brothers, where it's a grounding with my people. That's what we're doing right here. And we have to acknowledge those people who are doing this work now, because we won't know their value until they're gone. Nobody's going to big you up when you're here. They always big you up afterwards. And that's the shame. That's one thing I've been seeing during this situation with this COVID-19. We've lost a lot of great people in the UK that have done work that I know of. And around the world, it horrifies me to think of how many others we've lost. And they're being bigged up now. But I really wish that what I'm seeing now was done so they knew they were appreciated while they're here. So thank you, Brother Gus. I just want to say that before I say anything, you know, before we leave, and my memory goes again. I'm getting old.
getting better. Much obliged. We try to do what we can to solve this problem. Just talked about that this weekend, the monumental importance of Black journalists, long tradition. Marcus Garvey, Negro World, absolutely correct. Minister Malcolm X, Muhammad Speaks, Ida B. Wells Barnett, long tradition of Black journalists and their effort to try to solve this problem and share information globally. Person at 9401, did you have a question for Toyin Agbetu?
Good afternoon. I tuned in a bit late. I missed a good amount of the conversation. But one thing I was always curious about globally is, how is the testing in UK? Are people being tested in UK? And how, like, if you're sick, do you have to be sick to get a test? And how many people are being tested in the UK?
Now, you've hit a very sore point in this country. Testing in the UK is only just starting to get on top. We don't know how bad the virus has spread, because the government was made a promise that it was going to be doing 100,000 tests every single day. I don't have a reader. So I could try and find a figure. I think it's something like 1.5 million people are being tested. But what is happening is that essentially it's around 85,000 people are being tested each day now. And that's only happened in the last week. So we have no idea where the virus is, where it's concentrated, or anything. This is a big political issue, because like you just said, with the question you asked to about whether you have to be ill, that was the case. You only got tested if you went to hospital and you were found to have or suspected to have the virus, then they would test you. But because so many people have passed away in the care homes, I don't know what it's like in the States, probably the same here, but there's a very big culture about people placing their elders in care homes. And so you have a lot of vulnerable people there. The people who were in the care homes, not only were they not being tested, and that's now where most of this are taking place in the UK, but also the care workers who looked after them weren't being tested. So you've got to understand, like, so you might be working in a care home, you take an elder to a hospital to say, look, I think that they've got the virus. They might say, well, you know, we're not sure, take them back. You've actually picked up the virus while you're in the hospital, and you start spreading it, not only to the people who are in the hospital, but also people in the care homes. So it's a big issue. And so now the testing has been ramped up. They're saying that anyone who's on the front line who wants a test can have a test. And so the numbers are starting to slowly creep up. I think like today it was around 85,000. But the government promised it would be 100,000 a day. And they've missed that target every single day. They've just not made it. So it's a serious issue here. Community-wise, there is some people who are resistant to the idea of testing. You know, initially, I haven't heard this so much, but initially when the idea of testing came out, there were a lot of people talking about that they were going to use the test to inject a microchip into us. And so they're not going to take testing. And I haven't heard that theory so much now, but that was what was going on. Now, my take on this is quite simple. Like I said, I don't people who have got their theories, that's down to them. If that helps them to deal with this madness, I'm not going to start saying things about it. But when it comes to testing, I personally believe testing is crucial. The vaccine is another issue. That's another program completely. But the testing we need to have. Like my son, for example, I ain't putting him back in school until I know that all the staff in that school are being tested and all the children around the area or the parents we have an understanding have been tested and we have an idea that that school is safe. If I don't believe that that school is safe, he's staying at home. It really is as simple as that. And it'll be other parents like me. So testing for me is a crucial issue. And I think the government recognizes that now, but it's been trying to save money. And there's lots of nonsense things they've been doing. So I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. It does. I want to ask another question.
Please do.
PPE, right? You guys have a PPE shortage in the UK,
right?
Also?
Yeah, personal protection.
And is the majority of the healthcare workers not white and like African or Caribbean?
That's a complex
one. What's the makeup of the healthcare workers? Okay.
That's a difficult one. There's a large percentage, I think Gus had the statistics for that, in the National Health Service, who come from an African or Asian background. And so we have a large, I think it's something ridiculous, like 40. It's quite large because a lot of people immigrate to the UK and they work in for the healthcare system. But the PPE shortage isn't just the healthcare workers in the hospitals. It's also the healthcare workers in the care homes. There's a shortage for them. There's also the shortage of people on the front line. So the transport system, the public transport system workers, they were left exposed for months, really. So people could take the buses and trains, and they've started to die as well. And as with other frontline services, we're overrepresented in those services, driving the buses, driving the trains. And so slowly but surely, you know, they're finding different strategies to shield those workers. But the shortage in equipment has come about because of ideology. What happened is that just before this happened, Britain left the EU. You know, it's got its Brexit dream. You know, it's going to stand alone and reinvent Empire Part 2. And so what happened was that there was a scheme that the European Union was working with its members saying, we're going to try and buy PPE collectively. And it invited the UK to join that scheme. The UK, however, thinking itself so big, said, nah, we're not going to join that scheme. We'll do it ourselves. And of course, they couldn't. And so it's been chasing itself, trying to catch up. The PPE shortage has exposed, like the sister that we heard about today who lost her life, if she had a PPE, that person spitting in her face wouldn't have infected her. So this has been a long-going issue, and it's not getting any better. Some weeks you hear that they've sourced a lot of PPE and you know the hospitals are fine. Then it runs out. We've had ministers telling staff in hospitals to reuse PPE, and the hospital staff saying, you're crazy. You ministers, you don't work in hospitals. We're not reusing PPE that has been exposed to a virus. Are you crazy? There's all these kind of things. Today, we heard the government saying that because it's telling people who cannot work at home to go back into work. So that's basically frontline workers again, those who are working class. It's saying if you're on public transport, you should be wearing a face mask and you can use homemade face masks. Now, people are, you know, like the BBC ran this nice, cute little thing about how you can make your own, get your homemade face mask and all this kind of stuff, all this kind of nonsense. It's all very cute. But if you look at what's happening and you analyze what's happening, what the government is doing is actually, again, saving money. You see, around the world, when lockdown's been easing, the government has been providing people maybe one or two face masks a day. If you go into certain buildings, you get tested for your temperature, and they provide you with a face mask. The British government is trying to do it on the cheap. So it's saying, okay, we need the stuff that protects you, we'll give to the people in the hospital. Because, hey, if I had to go to hospital, I need to know that the staff is actually going to be okay and there to look after me. But we're going to tell the public to make the cute little face masks out of T-shirts and out of socks and out of head wraps and all these kind of things. That is what is going on in the UK today. So the PPE topic is quite complex. We've had PPE come into this country which they bought on the cheap, and then the health regulatory bodies have said that this stuff is not even safe. We can't use it. So it's quite a mixed case. But that's what's going on. It's not just an African-only issue when it comes to PPE. This is actually more an economic issue, and now they're trying to save face, but they're still trying to save money.
What you're saying right now, it sounds very familiar to what's happening in the States, because my aunt is a healthcare worker, and she had one mask for a month, and they told her to wash it and reuse it for a whole month.
Oh, God.
So it sounds, what you're saying, it's eerily, eerily familiar to what's happening right now. I really appreciate you answering my question. Thank you.
No, and thank you. And please stay safe. I think one of the things that is good that's happening, but again, it shouldn't have to happen, is that people are using 3D printers. You know, I mean, schools who've got little, not laboratories, little workshops. They're making masks and PPE, and they're giving them to hospitals, they're giving them to the care homes. So they're filling the gap where government is supposed to be doing it. So, you know, I understand, you know, the plight of your nurse and stuff. And this is why I wish we could hear these stories, because I'm pretty sure that the clown and the orange one are talking every day. Oh, yeah. You know, they are talking every day and sharing strategies, etc. And that's why what's happening to you over there is similar to what's happened to us over here. But we don't know until we have these kind of discussions. So I really appreciate you asking the question.
Much obliged to our caller. Again, we are a little bit outside of our normal broadcast time. I suspect we probably have a few more callers there, but folks are listening in live, and they certainly will have access to the archives to be able to review the discussion. Hopefully it will help them with a better understanding of all this. If they come out with a vaccine, let's say at the end of the year, are you going to take it, or do you have reservations?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I see my first instinct is, like I told you, it would be no. But, you know, I'm a parent. I have a vulnerability, two vulnerabilities, so I have to have a strategy. So my strategy now has changed slightly. My strategy, and you can hold me to account now, you know, is that I will never take the version one of any vaccine. I will possibly wait until version three comes out after I've seen what has happened the first, you know, two times with whatever happens with the vaccine, and then I will make a decision again then. But my instinct right now is that I will not take I will at least say version one of the vaccine. But my logic tells me that something has to give, unless the virus is killed by social distancing. And it can be, you know, if a nation is strict enough, like St. Lucia, you know, St. Lucia has eradicated the virus. You know, if a nation is disciplined enough, the virus will just have no host to jump to and it will die. But that requires a discipline that I don't think they actually even want to do that. And so the vaccine, like I said, it's not a straight yes or no answer, and I'm sorry that I can't give you one, but I'm very honest about, you know, my opinions on these kind of things. I'm not telling anybody to take the vaccine. I'm just saying that I have a responsibilities that, I mean, I'm also, you know, I have responsibilities to people that run around me, to my family, to my child, you know, to my children, I should say, and my wife. So I have to weigh it up continuously before those things happen. Same question back at you, brother Gus.
I'm not a parent, you know, so that is a major consideration that I do not have. I have kind of the same general philosophy. I'm generally very adverse to medications and such. Like, I don't even generally do aspirin. I think it was 2017. I got my wisdom teeth extracted, and they gave me the prescription for medication, and I didn't even get that filled. So, you know, I'm generally very, very adverse to medication. Like, just let my body do its natural thing, and, you know, so I would be very, or I am generally adverse to all vaccines. I would have to take a kind of similar to you, like a wait and see, like, let's see what the first round looks like, and, you know, are they going to come out 6 months later and say, oh my gosh, this, you know, makes your testicles, yeah, you know, like, I don't know, like, I would have to do some serious, like, talk about being a nerd. Oh man, it would be super nerd time. Like, it would be lots, because my general conduct would be no thank you. Like, they were just saying, I think in January, before all of this got here, at least, I think it was operating in China and what have you, but, you know, that was not a thing here at all. They were saying, you can't even give a flu shot away. We were in the middle of flu season, and they said, you can't give flu. You can't even pay people to take flu shots. And then this came, and they started saying, well, you should at least get a flu shot. And I said, why? Why is that? They just said, you can't even pay. The flu shot's not going to stop the COVID-19, so why do I need a flu shot? And they said, well, that'll keep the hospitals from being overwhelmed, because we don't want people with the flu, and then all the rest. I'm good. I'm still good. I don't want the flu. So, yeah, I would not be in the first batch of folks to sign up. Like, they said they had people who were signing up to go do the trial vaccine right now, and they showed some of that even here in Seattle. You can, you know, you can wait. Even when you get around to trial 1,000, I'll still probably be waiting.
Yeah, they were paying people over here. They were getting between £200 to £600 to start taking the injections for the trial.
Wow.
It's difficult, because I know the science. I know that it makes sense. I know that, you know, if the virus isn't killed, then there's going to have to be a vaccine. I get it. I understand it. I'm a parent. You know, I have friends who have different illnesses. I get it. But I also know white supremacy. I know a money opportunity. I know business. And, you know, like I said, it's like, you know, that first version is rushed out. It normally takes 10 years to develop a vaccine safely. Because, you know, this is why I say it's another program. When you create a vaccine, the first part of the vaccine program, when you develop one, is to see if it deals with the illness. That's the first part, and that can take around 2 to 3 years. The second part of the test is to see what the side effects are, because you need to leave a long enough time to see what the side effects are. It's like when we were speaking earlier, and I said that, you know, this virus has only been around for like, you know, 4 to 5 months, so I can't answer that question because it hasn't been around long enough. And I'm just straight about that. It's the same thing with a vaccine. So if anyone develops a vaccine in less than a year, you know, every scientist, everyone who works in epidemiology, or anyone who knows these kind of things, will tell you, there's no guarantee that that is a safe vaccine. It might deal with the virus and then introduce something else. And, you know, that's something that I am not putting into my body. I'm not telling my friends to put into their body. And I'm certainly not putting into my loved ones' bodies. But, of course, I know if the virus isn't sorted out and the worst thing happens, it mutates and it changes because, you know, it has its own kind of life. I hope it doesn't happen. I don't even like put my mouth on that. Then, you know, at some stage a vaccine will come. But any government that tries to make it mandatory, whoa, behold them, man. lo and behold them.
I think that is a fear a lot of folks have raised. Is this going to be mandatory? Like, will it be mandatory to attend school, like to be a teacher or a student, that you got to be vaccinated? Like, is it going to be mandatory to fly? Is it going to be mandatory for international flights to be like, just lots of things for certain jobs? Is it going to be mandatory, you know, to get hired? Like, because they already have that for certain. I think we had someone called in. They were talking about for just going to university or college. They had to get vaccinated for, like, hepatitis B or, you know, whatever it is. Like, yeah, they already have that as a requirement for some things. So if they do come with a vaccine, you know, they might try to take some of that discretion out of it. Like, if you want to fly, you're going to be vaccinated. If you want to go to school, you're going to be vaccinated. So
white supremacy is clever. I know we've got to wrap up, but white supremacy already has the answer for that one. You've got to remember, it's quite simple. It's economics. If you want your money, if you want your benefits, if you want, you know, this income, then you need to actually sign up for this. And that's the simple, that's what they'll do. I mean, they call it, in Korea, they'll call it a health passport. You know, when they're having this mobile phone with tracking software on it. So basically, you use that, you just make that the passport. And a lot of people will be forced. If people are not frightened to say to their employers, I'm frightened that I might die if I go to work today, can you please put me in the office? If they're frightened to say that, then people will be frightened to say to people, you know, to say, look, you know what I mean? I'm not taking that virus, you know what I mean? Because they're scared of losing their salary. So this is the issue that's going to be played about. I'm pretty sure of it. I'm pretty sure. The health passport thing will be a big thing, you know. It's like, this is not new. This is a tactic that they've done before, and so we have to be prepared for that. The good thing about that is that if they use mobile phones, then there'll be people like me who will just hack it, and I'll just have a fake certificate on my phone. It's as simple as that. So we'll see what happens. We'll deal with that. As long as we're around, we'll deal with that. We're very creative people, we Africans, man. We survived much worse.
Visit the website legally.org for more information about Mr. Toyin Agbetu, the great work that they're doing over in the UK. You can follow on Twitter as well. They've been talking quite a bit. That was how I was reminded, like, oh yeah, we should get him back on the program. Follow him on Twitter to see what they're talking about, to get updates on this whole situation. And absolutely, I think it's important to continue this sort of dialogue. So perhaps we can get you back on hopefully sooner than later to get an update on how the whole reopening phase goes in the UK and how that unfolds, if there's a second wave or a vaccine or whatever it's going to be, just to continue to exchange views and information, hopefully help people get a better grasp as they make decisions and try to keep themselves safe. But thank you so much for hanging out with us this Tuesday evening. Super appreciated the dialogue. Wish you and your wife the best in taking care of your child's safety and education, and hopefully you all will come out of this ready to roll, feeling healthy, great, doing well, and ready to keep up the outstanding work that you do.
Thank you very much, Brendan. Same to you as well. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure was ours, sir. Mr. Toyin Agbetu joining us live from the United Kingdom. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and we will definitely be in touch soon, sir.
Take care, bro.
Yes, sir. Good evening.
Peace.
Context of white supremacy. Greetings, truck driver in Houston, just saw him. As I said, we will have a number of programs that are outside of our normal time schedule. I love broadcasting where we can just be consistent. Just 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. Bang, bang, bang. You can just rely. And then, you know, the compensatory call in 1 hour later. But like being consistent. But I also think it is super important to be able to talk to non-white people, white people, just folks in general in different parts of the world. White supremacy racism is global. This pandemic is global. So I think that can help us make better sense of what is happening on the planet, hopefully help us make better choices. I know it's a very stressful time. It's a very confusing time. So hopefully getting more information and hearing what's happening all over the globe can help us kind of manage, make sense of what we are dealing with. Definitely make sure. I know the audio went out briefly. The archive should be pristine when we lost the connection for a moment, but archive should be perfect. But I thought that was so important where he talked about he was headed home. He saw a black female being accosted by enforcement officials, and he, from a distance, was recording, still social distancing, and the officer came over and, "Hey, what are you doing? Get out of here. I'm going to fine you for violating the social distancing policy because you're not staying at home. You're out here, you know, being some sort of spy on us as we try and get this nigger straight." Wow. That is social distancing 2020, UK style. Mandatory mention of Henrietta Lacks. Forgot John Hopkins was mentioned. Henrietta Lacks. Henrietta Lacks. Like I said, I think it's super important being able to have folks on from around the world. This week we should be super international. Context of white supremacy. Our Global Sunday Talk on Racism should be back this Sunday, 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Looking forward. We missed it last month. I was really dissatisfied because I was so looking forward to hearing an update when we had the global podcast in March. They weren't even on lockdown in the UK. Like, it was still kind of, we'll see. We're going to the bar. That's like, they, I mean, it was just kind of, it was wild. Like, even talking to them, because I think at that time, things had started to lock down here in the States. It had not done so in the UK. So I was, you know, super excited to talk to everybody last month. And then we weren't able to make it happen. I believe this weekend we'll be able to have things back in place. So that'll be Sunday. Give folks another opportunity to talk directly with folks around the globe. Also, our black male in China, we should have him back on the program on Friday. Again, a little bit earlier. 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. I am hoping to get an update because they actually changed laws because Africans were being mistreated. We talked about that before. Talked about some of that with him last time around. And he talked about some of the Africans overstaying their visas and that being a part of the problem. I said I'm sure there's some racism, white supremacy within all of that. And I think some of the African countries pressured or voiced their concern about treatment of their various citizens, and so they made new legislation in at least one region of China to stop or at least to address the abuse anti-blackness against Africans. But we'll talk about that, what he's seen globally, the response over the past month. I think they've had some clusters. That's what it's being reported as in the news of the virus that have resurfaced in China. We'll discuss that. We'll be good. Check in with him again. Again, he did predict that the virus would have a devastating impact on black people in the States about a month before it actually took root. But he should be here on Friday. So that's at least two irregular times for our broadcast this week. Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Sunday, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Caller in China, listener in China, Friday. Global Sunday Talk on Sunday. White supremacy, racism, global. Health crisis, coronavirus, global. Let's see. I hope that folks, you know, getting all of this, are continuing to take things seriously until we have a lot of information, like he said about, you know, the vaccine, doing a lot of study, a lot of research. Until that time, we'd have to be take this seriously for you, family, relatives, you know, as best you can. Washing hands, social distancing, all of that. I would not be out in any crowds. I know the weather is nice and all of that, but yeah, I would put safety over even getting out and enjoying the sun. You can get out and enjoy the sun. I have done that, but I have done so by myself. You know, still social distancing and not hanging out with any folks. Take this seriously. Better to be safe than sorry. I was so appreciative of him mentioning or not, well, I thought it was important when he talked about domestic abuse over in the UK, because I had played a number of reports and mentioned that repeatedly. I've mentioned Mr. Fuller's suggestion first time, last time. That is why that is so crucial. When we start talking about hooking up and being with other people, to have that be a foundation of the relationship that's been talked about, maybe not from day one, but I mean from a very early stage. No violence. We're not going to be verbally violent. We're certainly not doing any physical violence. First time, last time. Said that repeatedly. It would be, I mean, talk about making a bad situation like exponentially worse. We have to deal with all this. And then I'm cooped up with some abuser, like, oh my gosh. Anxiety off the charts. First time, last time. Certain that there's a whole lot of that happening in this situation. I've talked about that before, so to hear that come up again from Mr. Agbetu, sad but not surprising. That is the system. They can set up, white people can, and they do. They set up situations that are just like a pressure cooker that do just kind of experiments to see how much pressure they can put on you and wait till things go bad. They can set up environments like that all the time, and they do. Construct environments like that all the time. We'll still be here for the book club, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Dr. Layla Africa, I think session 6, I think this week. And then workplace racism, neutralizing workplace racism on Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Normal times, doing our work, hopefully constructive, worthy of your time and energy. Can only say again, I hope under emergency conditions. Mr. Agbetu, he said that today. War being waged against us. He even made the correction to say it accurately. War is being waged against us, and we have to defend ourselves. That's the way he said it. That being the case, we don't have time, resources, energy to waste. Make sure you're getting constructive, worthwhile, logical information from the context of white supremacy. If not, do something else with your time and energy. Take this seriously. We don't have time to be fiddling around with some silly person talking nonsense on a podcast. And that should apply to everything, everybody. Like, we do not have time to waste. Folks should be logical. The way that we're investing our time and energy should be super worthwhile under these conditions. With that, any other folks listening in, any comments they want to make sure they get in before we conclude? I'll give folks a minute or so. You can get a hand up, *61, if you have any concluding comments before we wrap up. Truck driver in Houston, loyal investor, listener, good to hear from you, sir.
Greetings, Gus. You can hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I was going to email you, but I just wanted to, I didn't hear the interview. But I wanted to tell you, man, that that neighbor app, man, that was a good suggestion, man, to the caller that suggested that last week. Mm-hmm. Man, it's a lot of information on that app, man. I suggest everyone go ahead and subscribe to that app, man. It's very, very helpful, man. And that's all I had.
Love it. Love it. Constructive information. Constructive information. I'd heard that from a number of people, like racism, white supremacy, and just, you know, interesting tidbits. Like Dr. Welsing, she would say local, national, global. Now, we did our global Tone Day Talk coming this weekend, but things that are happening right, like on your block sometimes, you won't be informed about. You get that app. Wow. Didn't even know this was that. You might look on that. Negro suspected of shimmying nail boxes. Wow. I didn't even know that. Yes, get the app, check it out, see what they're talking about, where you, especially I would think if you live in an area with a lot of white people, yes, make sure you have it, check it out, and see what exactly they are talking about. Hopefully not you. Might be some
sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, did you have more? Did you have anything else you were going to say?
No, I was just agreeing with you because I had they had an alert on my app around my area where a guy was requesting that hogs be removed off of his yard. And I'm like, man, we're in the middle of Houston. Where is there hogs? So I started thinking, like, what could hogs be? Is that like black people? Is that like a new code word for black people? Like, it was crazy, man. It was crazy the stuff I've seen on that app, man. That's it.
It could be a code. You could be correct. I have been to Houston. It's been a minute, but I don't recall seeing hogs just
hogs
hanging out. But maybe I haven't been to the right part of Houston. So, yeah, it could be a code. Maybe it exists for real. But either way, check it out. See if you have any information there, if they're talking about anything. Might even be interesting with everything that's happening to see if they're talking about snitching, if they're doing any of that, because that's been so robust, them snitching on people for violating the lockdown and all that, to see if they're talking about that, if they're, you know, such and such looked like he was sneaking out and wasn't going to the store or whatever, if they're doing any of that there too. But make sure you download it, check it out, and again, hopefully they are not talking about you or anyone in your household, anyone that you know. Let's see, any other folks comments, suggestion they want to make sure they get in before we conclude? Dr. Niana Rasayan should be back with us soon as well. Been trying to, I keep saying I had talked to him and was trying to schedule a time, and it was just difficult getting things scheduled. He's still teaching remotely and all of that, and doing experiments, being an attempted scientist. But we should hopefully have him on the program within the next few days. We'll get some of his thoughts, suggestions on what we can do to keep ourselves safe in the midst of all this chaos. Again, I suspect race soldiers have been listening in. Sounds like it's just been third party interference the whole time, but to be expected. Anywho, we will be back at minimum on Thursday, and then I think twice Friday. If you have questions, comments, need additional information, trying to find something in the archives, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy racism for many, many reasons. Keep that brain computer operating well. We have got lots of really important information to evaluate. We will need our brain computer working at maximum efficiency. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. And again, we really shouldn't be going too many places. Now, we got that international now. Mr. Agbetsu said he gave us an exclusive, just him trying to walk to his residence. Black female accosted. He's from a distance just trying to observe and record, do the minimal, the little that he can from a weak position. And they come up and threaten him. Keep it moving, bub, or we'll arrest you for violating the social distancing. That's being out in public now. They had the report about the, they didn't say it was thousands, but, you know, anybody, one is too many. Black people being given summons in New York City for violating the social distancing policies and all of that. I just don't think it's a time where you want to be doing a lot of unnecessary travel. If you got to be out for work, or if you have to do something for your children, your family, you're going to the grocery store, what have you, essential things, no problem. But other than that, I would probably be trying to stay inside. Like, it's just not the safest time. You have lots, at least in the States, you have lots of armed race soldiers, badge or no, who are out and saying that they're upset about all kinds of things. Maybe internationally, maybe you don't have bands of armed hooligans, but it still seems like you have race soldiers with a badge who are out practicing racism, not law, not justice, and it's just not the climate, just not the time to be joyriding. We can wait a little bit late. I mean, the system of white supremacy in general is not that time, but right now, for real, is not that time. So, limited times when you do go out, you're buckled, you got your essential worker paperwork, your mask, or whatever you need, you're strategic, get what you need, and you're back in. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.